You may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Eugene Scalia representing the petitioners. I've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. The rule at issue here is a brazen attempt to exercise plenary regulatory authority over private funds. It's common ground between the parties that private funds, such as venture capital funds, are exempted by Congress from the Investment Company Act, or ICA. The ICA regulates mutual fund companies or other so-called pool investment vehicles that are available to retail customers, ordinary individual American investors. Because these vehicles are available to retail customers, Congress has subjected investment companies to a detailed, prescriptive regulatory regime from which it has exempted private funds. Private funds are reserved for sophisticated investors who Congress calculated had the wherewithal to pursue their own economic interests through a free market contract-based regulatory model. And indeed, that model has worked exceptionally well. Profits in private funds are substantially higher than the profits available in public markets. The size of investment in private funds has increased greatly over the last decade as various sophisticated investors have sought those higher profits. And in the meantime, fees being charged by advisors have declined, further evidence of a vibrant, robust, competitive market. Nonetheless, and for no good reason, the SEC here is attempting to subvert the statutory exemption provided to private funds and to conduct a hostile takeover of private funds. It seizes upon a provision of the Dodd-Frank Act that concerns retail customers and uses that to, as a backdoor way of bypassing the exemption from the Investment Company Act.
Let me ask you something in a way about the big picture of your case. I would say that the argument focuses on three sort of subparts of what the rule includes within it. And there's some argument by the SEC that insofar as the monetary impact and maybe other measurements, that's an actually fairly small part of the overall rule. Yet you're asking for vacater of the entire rule. How do we join those two together, that your direct attack is on three with some other issues being raised, maybe about the foundational fact of having adopted any rule at all, and you want a vacater of the whole? Why would we be inclined to vacate the whole rule, even if we agreed with you as to three individual parts of the rule?
Well, for multiple reasons, Your Honor. We were very clear in our petition for review and in our brief that we sought vacater in full. We said that this rule was flawed from root to branch. We identified three different grounds which independently warrant vacating the entire thing. First, our statutory arguments. No statutory authority, the whole thing comes down. Second, the failure to establish a need for this regulation. By the way, this is the same problem that ultimately resulted in vacatur just a couple of months ago of another SEC rule in the Chamber of Commerce case, establishing a need. That goes to everything that they adopted. So no statutory authority, no need, everything comes down. And then finally, their failure yet again to determine whether this action will promote competition and capital formation. The failure to come to grips with that has resulted in the downfall of multiple SEC regulations. It's a ground to vacate everything here. We focused, to be sure, on some of the worst features of this rule, but we've always been clear that we were challenging the entire rule, and the SEC's argument that, oh, well, there are multiple rules here and you only challenged a few is a red herring. When you actually look at their final rule, it calls itself a final rule. We challenged that final rule. We challenged the order by which it was adopted. So this entire regulatory package is in front of you, and all of the grounds we've identified take it all out, Your Honor.
Well, I certainly understand that some of your arguments would go to the entire rule. It does seem to me that the focus, perhaps, I don't want to overstate it, but to the extent that, for example, I'm not going to get the subparts right, but I'll just say the other matters component of Title IX or whatever of the amendment, whether that applies to any other parts of the rule, you haven't explained to us. And so to the extent there are problems with the limited language in subpart 1, subpart 2 of subpart H, all we really know from your briefing is how it interferes with three specific maybe not all three, but some of the specific rules that you have identified. So that's just a problem I have. And I know you're challenging the whole thing, but your briefing does worry me just a bit of whether we can reach the whole rule.
Well, but Your Honor, if I could, you know, respond to that.
It worries me. That worries me because I think we need to, but it worries me how your argument works.
Let me put your worries to rest, Your Honor. With respect to the so-called other matters provision, I mean, this is an ancillary mouse hole provision. It's not just a mouse hole, it's a misplaced mouse hole. Remember, in Title IV of Dodd-Frank, Congress...
Not supposed to be in mouse holes, I forget.
Elephants should not be in mouse holes, particularly in misplaced mouse holes, Your Honor. Title IV is where, in Dodd-Frank, Congress regulated private funds. Here we are, five titles later, in a provision that is all about retail customers, their relationship with broker-dealers and advisors. It has nothing to do with private funds. So they've seen...
Also like this, I mean, it's one thing to say, whatever this is, Title IX, Article IX, something like that, has this in it and is dealing with retail customers. Is there no other sprinkling of matters about private funds throughout this act, or is this the one example? It's the one example the SEC is using, perhaps, but I haven't studied the whole enactment to see if there may be other examples, like they're right on how...
There's no sprinkling, Your Honor. And so coming back to your initial question, our point is that the provision they're relying on, the other matters, is not about private funds, but this whole rule, the whole thing, is about private funds. So they're using a provision not about private funds to regulate only private funds. That's why all of this comes down. Now, with respect to whether private funds are addressed elsewhere, they are. And that's why this is so fatal to the SEC's argument, because Title IV is the title of Dodd-Frank that is, in fact, about private funds. It's titled, you know, hedge funds and I think other private funds. And what's notable is while the SEC says, hey, in Dodd-Frank, Congress gave us new authority over private funds, it's not using the private fund title. It's using some other title about retail customers, not private funds. The authority that SEC was actually given over private funds is extremely limited and actually shows it can't exercise the authority here. So just to give you some examples, Your Honor, again, common ground, private funds are exempted from the ICA. The ICA has requirements regarding regulating by shareholders of advisor compensation, about disclosing performance information semi-annually to investors, and about so-called senior securities, shares that have superior rights. Private funds are exempted from all of those regulations, and yet the SEC, through this back door in this other matters provision that's not about private funds, is trying to regulate all of the things from which the private funds were exempted. And then when you look at Title IV, here's an example of what Title IV actually gives the SEC authority to do. It says to the SEC, you can require that private fund advisors retain and make available to you information regarding their profitability, their assets, and regarding these so-called side letter agreements. It stops there. It doesn't say you can require private fund advisors to make those materials available to their investors. Now, that is a requirement in the Investment Company Act, doesn't apply here. Congress stopped short of it here. But again, what the SEC is saying, ignore all of that. Let's go to another part of this statute that has to do with retail investors and use that as the source for our authority. It's a classic end run, and again, an attempt to use a provision intended for one thing to accomplish a vast regulatory purpose. And there should be no mistaking the scope of what they're attempting to do. I don't believe the SEC has identified anything that is done under the Investment Company Act that it thinks it can't do through this extremely broad interpretation of this other matters provision. I'm not aware of anything. It's saying it can regulate the terms for investing in private funds, how they're governed. It's saying it can regulate what private fund advisors are compensated for. It's plenary authority. And again, in an area where they're not supposed to be able to regulate in this same way, they're doing it, moreover, in a vibrant sector of the economy that they haven't shown is in need of this kind of regulation.
So I'll ask your opponent as well, but was there no invocation of that provision, the other matters provision, prior to this case where they sought to touch private funds in some regulatory manner?
I think there may have been one single minor instance a few years ago where it's been used. Never ever before has it been used in this sweeping manner, certainly not in a way that has caused the controversy that you have here. In this case, you have venture capital firms, private equity firms, and hedge funds all saying that this is an unprecedented intrusion on our regulatory model. And Judge Engelhardt, our concern is not merely what they're doing here, but the scope of the authority that they're claiming to be able to regulate, again, the terms for investing, how these advisors are paid, and also the supposed conflicts of interest, including, I mean, their definition of a conflict of interest includes if you and I are on opposite sides of the bargaining table, well, there's a conflict of interest, we get to step in. That's nobody's understanding of a conflict of interest the SEC can regulate. I want to underscore, too, the agency's failure to properly determine what the consequences of this action would be. This was a rushed rulemaking process. Commenters' concerns were disregarded. The inspector general of this agency has been troubled about what the IG itself called its aggressive regulatory agenda. And part of the way the SEC has achieved that is by running roughshod over its obligation to determine as best it can the economic impacts of its actions. Here, it never came to terms with what the actual impact would be on competition. It looks very bad when you read what they have to say about the impacts, but they never came to ground on what the net impact would be. Same thing on—
The SEC argues that they did not have the necessary information to make that analysis, or is that another part of the response to your argument?
They respond to an argument we did not make, Judge Southwick. Our argument was never that they failed to make a proper quantitative assessment. They have some shortcomings in that regard. Our disagreement is more fundamental. Even if they were permitted to rely on a qualitative assessment, they never made that qualitative assessment. We're not saying they had to be certain in every particular, but we are saying they had to make a predictive judgment, and they didn't do it. This is a $5.4 billion a year rule. The SEC has admitted that it is going to cause some small advisors likely to go out of business, that it will present new entrants. What harm to investors have they identified that justifies putting small businesses out of business? They never came to terms with that. They never explained what the overall net effects would be. And that is a reason, again, to vacate the rule in full. But the court does not need to reach these issues. The court does not need to get any farther than the fact that the agency is relying on an authority that concerns retail customers to regulate private funds, which Congress has been so clear it wanted exempted from the intrusive regulation of the Investment Company Act. And remember, part of the way that the SEC is doing this, one of their arguments is, well, you know, we're not actually regulating the private fund, we're regulating the private fund advisor. But in their own brief, they say that the private fund advisors, they say, exercise exclusive authority over the affairs of private funds. So it's sleight of hand. They are essentially claiming that everything the Investment Company Act does as to private funds, they themselves can do under the pretext that they are merely regulating private fund advisors. I want to comment finally on, I mentioned the concerns with the rulemaking process. I think the court does not need to reach these things because the statutory authority is so plainly absent. But with respect to how this rulemaking was conducted, another recurring problem with SEC rulemakings now is that they propose one thing, and then they pose hundreds of questions about other things they might do. And then they show up in court and say, oh, well, yeah, we changed the rule enormously, but we actually had a question about that, so it's okay to do. This is just another example of how this was an unfair rulemaking process in which the public did not have an adequate opportunity to participate.
If we get past the statutory authority, if we get past those sort of threshold issues that you say doom the whole rule, if we get into arbitrary and capricious considerations. I think what you're getting into now was this part of the rule or that part of the rule a logical outgrowth of the notice and comment process. There, per Judge Southwick's earlier questions, are we looking at maybe a severance and vacate, something less than a full vacatur, or are we still looking at fully vacating the rule?
Well, I think my principal response to that, Judge Wilson, as you anticipated, is that you needn't reach these issues. The statutory authority is absent. I will also point out that every one of the specific provisions we've challenged, including those as to which there was insufficient notice and comment, relates back to a subject that private funds are exempted from under the Investment Company Act. So take, for example, their failure to give proper notice about this requirement that you get shareholder consent to fees for investigations. Under the Investment Company Act, private funds are exempted from the need to get shareholder approval for their compensation. Voila, the SEC shows up, has this back door, and is now regulating fees under this provision about retail customers. But I think you're correct, Your Honor. If you were to find that everything else they said was correct and the only flaw was on the notice and comment, then that might be a ground to vacate just as to those provisions. But again, the flaw that underlies those provisions is the same flaw that underlies the entire rule, which is this lack of statutory authority.
I mean, if I could, I think we're tracking that when we get into these kinds of things we're talking about, it's really hard to vacate the portions of the rule that are not being challenged or that you haven't detailed, you know, how the notice and comment proceedings proceeded, that sort of thing. Thank you.
Yeah, and just to answer, that is a specific challenge, but that provision, like this entire rule, is being challenged for the three separate overarching reasons we've identified. Right. Thank you.
Have you appeared in front of this court on other SEC matters recently?
I have, Your Honor. I wouldn't necessarily say recently. I think it was two summers ago. So, but I'll be back here on Thursday.
Welcome
or another SEC matter. But thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. The commission adopted five separate rules for private fund advisors that enhance transparency and reduce conflicts of interest for private fund investors, including public pension funds that serve stakeholders, including millions of firefighters, police, and teachers.
So would you agree that Title IV does not contain authority for the final rule we're here about today?
I mean, we keep talking about Title IV. That's the part of Dodd-Frank that added provisions. I don't think that necessarily negates the authority here, where the provision, which
if it gives the SEC the authority to
the authority we're relying on.
You're arguing that Title IV gives you the authority to do this final rule anyway, so that we don't have to look at other matters, or do you concede that, no, Title IV is not what we should be looking at, it's in this other matters section?
That is correct, Your Honor. We have two grounds of authority. One is 211H, which is under the title Other Matters, and I can get to why that's not as important as petitioners make it sound. The other grant of authority is Section 206.4, which petitioners haven't even mentioned during their oral argument, and those two provisions provide authority for all five separate rules. If we can go to 211H, so this was added as part of Dodd-Frank in 2010. The text of that phrase does not use the word retail customers. It uses the word investors. And if you
everywhere
look
everywhere else around that section is clearly pertaining to retail customers.
I think we have a difference of opinion with petitioners about if we're going from text to structure, which structure we should be looking at. I would submit it does not matter, but I think this court should look to how it looks in the U.S. Code in Section 211 first. And I think in that, the structure is very clear that Congress is moving from using the term investors to apply to all investors. And I'd ask the court to triangulate 211A, which talks about private fund investors, then 211G, which uses retail customers and specifically defines the term retail customer. And then you get to 211H, what the commission is relying on. And the term retail customer appears nowhere. Instead, the word is investor, which is generally a broader term that Congress consistently used to describe all investors, including private fund investors.
Do you agree that historically, from 1940 on, we've always, we meaning the country, let's be specific, Congress, has always treated as a dichotomy private investors versus retail, that those have never been, those terms have never been commingled until this particular case. Would that be a fair statement? Would you concede that?
I actually would not concede that. When Congress uses the term investors, it means all investors. Simply because an investor is sophisticated, because they have a lot of wealth, does not mean they don't enjoy the protection of the securities laws. Now, to be to Your Honor's point, Congress does at times be more specific and describe talk about retail customers, and it certainly did so in parts of Dodd-Frank. So, Judge Wilson, if we want to move from Section 211 to Section 913, the part of Dodd-Frank that added Section 211H, it uses retail customer in every single part subsection of 913, except the one that adds 211H. Then it uses this broader term, investors. And I'd note at the same time in Title IV, which is also governing private fund investors, Congress repeatedly uses the term investors to describe, to talk about private fund investors. In the definition of foreign private advisor, which is Section 202A30, it counts in terms of the number of individuals that are in the U.S. about whether a private fund investor is foreign or domestic, the number of investors in private funds. It's clearly assigning weight, and I think this court, as a matter of text and structure, has to recognize a difference between the term investors and the term retail customers. My friend is just incorrect that when Congress was defining and writing 211H, it's only talking about retail customers. Why, if in the provision before it uses the phrase retail customers, and it wanted 211H to only apply to retail customers, why wouldn't it use the same word? It would have if that's what it meant, but instead it used the broader term investors. And the
I'm asking the same thing you just ably responded in answering to Judge Engelhardt, but isn't reading other matters that way, aren't you putting the weight on that, if not to eliminate, at least to greatly reduce the distinction that in the past has existed between private funds and public funds?
I don't think we are, and I emphasize the text of the provision itself, not the title. There's obviously plenty of cases out there that say the title shouldn't be focused on instead of the text. Now, I grant you, though, that the title's there in courts.
This is a significant power you are exercising that you would not have had before subpart H, other matters. Is that correct?
Well, we are
allowed to do things with private funds that you were not allowed to before, and this statute is what allows you to do it.
This, but we also have a separate grant of authority. But with regard to 211H, if the other grant of authority didn't exist, that thought experiment.
Really is talking about fraud and related things, and that somehow this all gets wrapped up in there, and maybe it does. But insofar as specific beyond that, just general regulation, it's other matters that gives you that authority that you did not have before to deal with private funds.
Yes.
That's a question, by the way.
For private fund advisors, yes. We fundamentally disagree with the idea that we're...
Either way, but private fund advisors this time.
Yes, I mean, we think there's a pretty significant difference between private fund advisors and private funds, and I think there's a big difference between us and petitioners. But the short answer to your question is yes, Your Honor.
I'll give you a short question. I'll take a short answer.
Waste its time with Title IV if, in the end, they were going to say, well, here's this other matters provision, and, oh, by the way, we're going to put a little provision that uses the word, and you're right, curiously enough, investors, but in so doing, we have now let the camel's nose in the tent, and the SEC can now go forth and promulgate as it sees fit.
But I don't think that's what Congress was doing, Your Honor. I think Congress put this provision, 211H, in Title IX, I think it did that all at once because it wanted this to apply to both private fund investors and retail investors or customers. I think it wanted to use the broadest phrase investors to encompass both because part of what Congress was dealing with Dodd-Frank were issues related to retail customers and retail investors as well. I'd also really resist the idea that Title IV, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So you're, to make sure I understand your argument, you're saying that we should look at the statutory scheme as having provisions that are just for private fund investors. We should look at the scheme to have provisions that are just for retail customers, and then other matters would be where it dovetails in, and these would apply to, unless otherwise, it's apply to everybody.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think Congress has given you the footholds to do that when it uses those terms. But what I was going to say, Your Honor, is I also resist the idea that Title IV and Title IX are somehow hermetically sealed. And Title IV only deals with private fund advisors. Title IX only deals with retail customers. Title IX deals with a lot of other things that don't just touch on retail customers, including private offerings under something called Regulation D, which is only available to sort of high worth accredited investors. It deals with asset-backed securities. It deals with credit rating agencies. The point being that Title IX isn't just a retail customer only provision. So I think it's incorrect to look at those two as not having any overlap. I think the reality is they actually do have a substantial amount of overlap.
Title IV deals with private funds.
Private fund advisors, yes.
Yes. And I mean, there again, back to Judge Southwick's point, historically, this has been a pretty bright divided line. The Investment Companies Act of 1940, the Advisors Act, they've always distinguished between the two. So doesn't it tell us something that there's a separate title about private fund advisors, and yet here we go with this plenary authority in Section 211H in Title IX?
I think I'd resist the idea that there's that divide you're talking about between.
Well, I mean, wouldn't the word investors in 211H then possibly go toward these other matters that are also included in Title IX as opposed to private fund advisors?
I think that's our point, yeah, is investors, the phrase used in 211H does include beyond just private fund investors. It includes a broader.
My point is you just detailed private offerings and this and that and the other that are all in Title IX as well. Private fund managers or private fund advisors are not in Title IX other than in 211H, right?
I mean.
Under your reading.
Yeah, in effect, yes, that the investment the term investment advisors that appear in 211H is not somehow limited to only investment advisors for retail customers. It's describing investment advisors broadly. Private fund advisors certainly fit within the definition of an investment advisor under Section 202A11. So, I mean, I think yes is the short answer to that question.
Let me ask you, the very first part of this, I don't know if it's the first part of Title IX, it's at least the first part of the section in which 211H appears. The commission shall have authority from time to time to make, issue, amend, rescind such rules, regulations as are necessary or appropriate to the exercise of functions conferred to the commission under this subchapter. So it does seem to me that perhaps the rest of that could reasonably be read. I mean, all of this is context, as you appreciate as well as we do. And so what is the context for what's going on in either the overall subpart ADB-11 or something else? Can you tell me what is the subchapter about that it's referring to? It ain't going all the way back to Title IV, does it? Again, you may not have been focusing on that language, and I'm just throwing it at you, but
yeah.
The first part of ADB-11 says that, I mean, certainly the fundamental powers of the commission to adopt regulations exists someplace else, but this one says the commission can adopt regulations under this subchapter. And so I'm just asking, what is the subchapter about? If you can tell us, and if not, I'll look at
it. The subchapter in that reference is the investment advisor.
Is it Title IX? Is it Title IV as well?
No, that in the U.S. Code is referring to the entire Investment Advisors Act. Title IV and Title IX are things that is Dodd-Frank adding provisions and, frankly, sprinkling it everywhere. So just as an example, all the provisions of 913 my friend is referring to that use the term retail customers, those appear as a note in the Exchange Act, a totally different statute, which is why if you were to look or your clerks were to look on the U.S. Code, they're not going to see any of these other provisions, 913A through G, because they appear in a different place. Because what Congress is doing in Title IV and Title IX, and frankly with all of Dodd-Frank, is doing a lot of different things and sprinkling it all over the U.S. Code. In our view, if you're going to go beyond the text, which just uses the term investors, and go to the structure, you should be looking at 211H first. 913 is still helpful. And it does support our argument, but you go with the structure at 211.
Well, why don't we look at, or you look for me, at 206 subpart 4.
Yes.
As whatever we make of your argument on this, you indicated to this that at least this will give you additional help or substitute help if we don't buy your argument so far.
Yeah, so 206.4 is the second grant of authority for all five rules, and 206.4 is a prophylactic.
So would it support the entirety of this rule?
Yes. Yes, and it is a prophylactic anti-fraud authority, and it allows the commission to prescribe means reasonably designed to prevent fraud. And it's very similar to the statute that the Supreme Court looked at in O'Hagan, which is a 1997 case that we cite in our brief. It's almost the identical language, and it is meant to be, again, prophylactic rulemaking authority. And the commission explained in its release how all five of the rules perform that function of being means reasonably designed to prevent fraud.
Without Section 211, your argument, if I understood you just now, is that 206.4 still grants the authority.
Correct.
To act as to this final.
Correct. So if your honors conclude, for instance, that 211H just doesn't work for us, 206.4 still justifies upholding these rules because it is an independent grant of authority. It has no connection. Well, I shouldn't say it has no connection, but it is not linked to 211H in that sense. I did want to respond to one other thing my friend said about. He said that we're exercising plenary regulatory authority over private funds. He's called it a hostile takeover. I want to articulate exactly how incorrect that is. I agree, and I think all the parties agree, that private funds are exempt from the Investment Company Act, but I think it's helpful to look at what exactly that means and how these rules aren't touching that. So for instance, if your honors belong to, or if your honors hold any holdings in mutual funds, I know many Americans do, there's public reporting requirements, quarterly and periodic public reporting requirements. Our rules aren't requiring any of that. There's no public reporting. There's a requirement of independent board members for mutual funds, for registered investment companies. Private funds are exempt from that. Our rules are not changing that at all. That's also true with regard to changes in investment strategy. If you're a registered investment company, a mutual fund, you have to get shareholder approval for certain types of changes in investment strategy. Our rules aren't changing that at all. Our rules, these five rules, are common sense rules designed to give more information to private fund investors and to allow them some say via disclosure or consent in certain types of fees they're paying, the money they're paying to the private fund advisors. Ultimately, my friend's argument boils down to these are sophisticated investors, they can handle themselves. But the reality is, and you are hearing it from the pension funds that have submitted amicus briefs and have submitted comments, and I'll just use the Louisiana Municipal Police Employee Retirement System, LAMPERS, as an example. They joined one of the amicus briefs. They're saying, in fact, we need more information, and that all is not right in the private fund space. And yes, private funds have amount of money has grown significantly and has produced returns, but you have private fund investors, which are pension funds, upon which ordinary Americans rely, saying we need more information about fees, we need more information about performance, we need more information, and that's all these rules are doing. This is basically a disclosure regime, something that
On the flip side, how would you respond to the amicus brief that was filed by the Committee for Capital Markets Regulation? I think in that brief they put in the negative light things like price competition, general data. I mean, the amicus brief kind of lays out, I think, the counter argument. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, and we dealt with that in the release, meaning the CCMR brief. They're pointing out a lot of information that was presented in the comments, and the commission responded to that. I get that amicus is, and my friends are going to continue to disagree with us on that, but that's not really the test. The test is whether we reasonably considered the issues and reasonably explained our policy choices, and we passed both those tests, either as a general APA matter or in terms of the economic analysis. And if you just take the first part of that, the general APA, not the economic analysis, but did we provide a rationale? Yes, we explained in the release why we were doing this, why there's a lack of transparency, there's conflicts of interest, there's a lack of effective role in governance that are affecting pension plans who are principally responsible for the rise in private funds over the last decade, which I'd add, coincides with Congress's decision to regulate private fund investors to a greater extent.
Let me ask you about, I think we're kind of close to this point, about the arbitrary and capricious evaluation. The commission cites, and I think I'm quoting here, a few dozen examples of the need for the final rules that are the subject, the provisions that are the subject of our hearing today. What can we look at to appreciate that you only need a few dozen examples of wrongdoing or mischief making when we're talking about an industry, and I think both of you all agree on the size of the billions of dollars, there are thousands of players in this business and so on and so forth, and that it's boomed in the last two or three decades. Why would we be satisfied with a few dozen?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think courts have set out a hard and fast line of exactly the number of amounts of wrongdoing.
Close to this, on a relative scale of the size of the industry versus the number of samples we should consider to justify the rule, what should we look at that might be analogous to this?
I mean, one thing that comes to mind is a lot of the cases that have arisen in the pay-to-play space. This is far thematically afield, but it is an example where courts have looked at one, two, three, four examples that are seem particularly dangerous in the sense of what can happen two, three steps down the line. I would put those out as an example. Wagner v. FEC is an example. The commission has a pay-to-play rule where we've talked about a few of these. Blunt versus SEC is one of those cases. So I'd give it, but I would definitely urge the court to not sort of adopt any hard and fast rule, and also recognize that the enforcement actions are one piece of the puzzle here in terms of why the commission acted. They're an important piece. And I don't think several dozen is anything to sniff at. I think they're important, particularly given the commission's limited resources. They may very well be the tip of the iceberg.
How many of those are settlements?
They're mostly settlements, Your Honor. And
those are not settlements.
I believe they're all settlements, Your Honor.
All settlements.
I believe they're all settlements, Your Honor, but I would not use that, as my friend suggests, to discount their value in terms of explaining to the commission that there's a problem. And the reason is, when there's a settlement, the commission is still explaining either the complaint or the order, if it happens to be an adjudicative proceeding. That's the commission's basically recitation of what it learned during its investigation, that there's a problem and that it's dedicating its resources to that particular problem. But there's more than just enforcement actions here. There's also the reports of a decade of reporting, which was required by Dodd-Frank under Section 204. This is Form PF, which is mentioned in the brief a few times. There's also exam priorities of the commission. And there's also comment letters, again, from pension funds, from investors themselves, saying, here are the problems. Here is the market failure that is occurring. Here's the information and bargaining asymmetry that is making it difficult for us to play on anything even resembling a level playing field. So it's not just the enforcement.
I don't know much, but what I remember of economics, all the economics seem to suggest that there isn't a market failure at all. There's market success.
Well, I think I guess the way I'd say it is in this particular instance, I wouldn't assume that the rising tide is lifting all boats equally. There's market success in the sense that a lot of money has come into to private funds. I don't think anyone's disagreeing with that. Whether the success of that and the value of that, if I can, thank
please
you.
Please finish your answer.
Whether the success and the value of that has affected all people evenly, you're hearing from commenters, you're hearing from pension funds, that is not correct. That they are unable to negotiate.
Affecting all people evenly, I thought what we had here were private fund advisors and private funds. That's the sort of fiduciary relationship.
That's the fiduciary relationship, but that's the private fund is in essence the company itself, the investment vehicle. The private fund advisor is the engine of the private fund, but the money that gets invested, that's coming from private fund investors, which is increasingly public pension funds. You know, I didn't have a chance to talk about the economic analysis. If I could just say very, very quickly that the commission delivered a robust economic analysis. It did consider efficiency, competition, and capital formation. It took into account quantitative data when it could, and when it couldn't, it explained why. And there's no requirement that all analysis be quantitative. Qualitative analysis and speculative decision making is permissible.
You don't have the economic analysis for whatever reason. And you've heard questions from my two colleagues about concerns about the evidence of a problem. What is your best support that this rule is even necessary? What would you have us think about?
I would have you think about this. I'd put yourself in the shoes of a smaller pension fund. Take Lampers, $2.5 billion pension fund. They're not Yale. They're not Abu Dhabi. They are facing situations where they can't get information, and you, the head of Lampers, I'm putting you in that seat for a moment, you have your own fiduciary obligations to the state and to your beneficiaries. You can't get clear information about how much you're even paying for the returns you may or may not be getting, because you're not even getting, absent these rules, clear information about the returns. You're also finding that Yale and Abu Dhabi jumped ahead of you in line in terms of redemption rights and information rights. That's the value of this rule, is it gives the Lampers of the world a chance to earn and enjoy the benefits of the private fund industry to a greater extent. I'm over my time, Your Honor, but I would just add, when it comes to how this court is going to assess these rules, please recognize that they did not discuss two of these rules at all in their brief. There are five individual rules that should be treated differently, and if there are APA procedural concerns, we don't think there are, we've explained why in the brief, those should be assessed in peace. Vacatur in its entirety is not the way to go here.
if that is, for some reason, the commission, excuse me, the court finds a problem with one aspect of this rule.
I expect you have much more you'd like to tell us as well, but
limited time. Thank you, Your Honor.
You read your briefs.
First, with respect to the settlements, I will confess, I've settled cases, and at times I've done it because I thought I had a weak case. It is a frightening prospect the federal government can bring 2 or 3 dozen cases, settle them, perhaps because it thinks it has a weak case, and then use those settlements with a relative handful of companies to impose on an entire industry a rule that will cost $5.4 billion a year, and which the government does not dispute will put small advisors out of business. They have not justified that. With respect to plenary regulatory authority, the SEC only briefly said that this rule does not exert plenary regulatory authority. That is not our point. Our point is they are claiming a plenary regulatory authority. They are saying they can dictate the terms on which people invest in private funds. And that includes, for example, saying that no advisor can have a contract in which a fund that's established pursuant to the contracts does not have, for example, independent directors. They've already, as I've explained, purported to regulate senior securities, which the ICA does. There's no limit given how broadly they are defining sales practices. With respect to structure and context of the statute, this court, and in fact this panel, just last month in Texas v. Becerra, emphasized how important it is to consider the context, the structure of the statute. Section 913 of Dodd-Frank is well known to have been concerned with a specific problem, and that is the perception that broker-dealers were not as held to as high a standard as advisors when dealing with retail customers, and perhaps a higher standard should be imposed on broker-dealers, one similar to the advisor standard. That's what 913 is about. This other matters provision is not a trap door through which the SEC may regulate private funds.
And then, fair to say that that section, though, is more than just about retail customers.
Yeah, and if I could address that, first of all, the SEC itself has used investors in lieu of customers, as it has said, to reach the relationship at an earlier stage when somebody has not yet made a purchase, is not yet a customer. Secondly, this language in 211 is concerned with the advisory relationship. But Judge Wilson, I think as you were pointing out, there is not an advisory relationship between the private fund advisor and the investor. And so there is not an advisory relationship between the two of them to be regulated. And Congress and the courts have repeatedly told the SEC not to regulate the investors like they are clients. On top of that, if you look at the actual language, the reference is to the commission acting when it deems things contrary to the public interest and the protection of investors. Those phrases, public interest, protection of the investors, are regulatory guardrails that the securities laws use occasionally, including in the provision we've cited regarding efficiency, competition, and capital formation. They don't tell you who may be regulated, which is how the SEC is trying to interpret it here. If I could comment briefly on Section 2064, it's actually kind of remarkable because most of the SEC's argument is we've got this fabulous new authority over private funds. It's not in the private fund title. It's in the retail customer title. But then they turn around and say, oh, and by the way, we've had all of this authority since 1960 under 2064, although the SEC, you may have noticed, did not once mention fraud, which is what 2064 is about. Finally, with respect to the scope of our challenge and the scope of relief, it's just APA 101. We challenged final rule. That is what they adopted. They adopted it pursuant to an order, and the SEC has not disagreed that we have identified 3 separate grounds to vacate this entire final rule.
Well, there was some extension for the SEC. Do you want another minute? I'm not forcing it on you.
If there are no further questions, I think I'm done.
All right, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to both of you for helping us understand this case. That is it for our special panel sitting. We'll take both cases under advisement, and we are adjourned.